available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Nigel Hewin, to this edition of Outlook, being recorded on Wednesday, the 28th of January 2026. And in this edition, Elaine will be going to Prinsthorpe to find out about that village. We start a story about a lady who was badly injured, and is very positive about her progress from that injury. And of course, you remember last week we started about the family, Alistair Wood, who always thought his family was a little odd. We'll find out more about that from Bill this week. And what about school trips? How many of you remember your school day trips? Well, Danny Thompson in the Coventry Telegraph has written about it, and Elaine will tell us more about that later. And finally, we're going to end this edition with a visit to Kenilworth Castle and Robert Dudley and Queen Elizabeth I and what they were getting up to in their shenanigans in those days. But of course, we've also got the sport, your postbag, and news from the Hub. But as ever, we're going to start with the local news roundup with Elaine and myself.
Outlook News.
The Women Against State Pension Inequality campaign, known as WASPI, is pushing on with its demands for Department of Work and Pensions compensation. The campaigners continue to push for payouts from the DWP for the millions of 1950s-born women impacted by the rise in the state pension age for women from 60 to 65 and then 66. They argue that the DWP failed to adequately notify the women of the change, with many finding out at the 11th hour and having their retirement plans thrown into disarray. They are awaiting the government's latest decision on how the issue should be resolved. Labour announced in December 2024 that there would be no compensation, despite the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman previously recommending the women should receive between £1,000 and almost £3,000 following their investigation into the matter. However, ministers did accept the Ombudsman's finding that there was maladministration on their part, as they should have sent out letters to the women sooner. In December 2025, ministers announced they would revisit the decision. This announcement came just as the DWP was preparing to face a High Court judicial review of the original decision, which WASPI had requested. In the initial decision, ministers also pledged to develop an action plan to improve their communication efforts, following recommendations to do so from the Ombudsman in its report. However, with little progress made a year later, the Ombudsman expressed serious concerns about the lack of action in a letter to the Work and Pensions Committee in January this year. Appearing before the committee on January the 21st, DWP Permanent Secretary Peter Schofield explained the reason for the delay. He said, "There's a formal, serious exercise going on, which is retaking a really important decision by government. The action plan itself flows from a previous decision that has now been retaken, so there's a formal government process here underway. That means I have to stop work on the implementation of the previous decisions. That's the formal position I'm under." WASPI representatives were present in Parliament to witness the DWP giving account. Speaking afterwards, WASPI campaign chair Angela Madden said, "We didn't expect much from the committee meeting because it's more to do with the performance of the DWP. However, she stated they will insist it persist in their efforts for compensation. She declared, "Our focus will remain on encouraging the minister to implement the Ombudsman's recommendations in full, rather than picking or choosing. The fresh decision is expected to be announced by early March."
University Hospitals Coventry in Warwickshire officially declared a critical incident on January the 23rd at the end of last week due to severe and sustained pressure on its services. The hospital reported significant and unacceptable delays for patients in both the emergency department and on regular hospital wards. Chief Nursing Officer Tracy Brigstock stated that despite staff working tirelessly, the current demand for care is exceeding the hospital's physical and operational capacity. As of the morning of the declaration, live wait times for both the adult and children's emergency departments were recorded at over 6 hours. Residents were being strongly urged to avoid A&E unless they were facing a genuine life-threatening emergency. And West Midlands Ambulance Service emphasised that 999 should only be called for serious incidents like unconsciousness, severe blood loss or drowning to ensure resources remain available for those in greatest need. The hospital is directing patients with non-life-threatening issues to use NHS 111 online, visit local pharmacies for mild ailments such as sore throats and UTIs, or contact their GP. This declaration follows similar critical incidents at other nearby trusts, including Warwick Hospital, which faced similar pressures just a week prior. The Trust clarified that the decision to declare a critical incident was made specifically to protect patient safety by managing the overwhelming influx of patients. Hospital leadership has apologised for the disruption and requested that the public remain patient and kind to staff members who are working under extreme pressure during this period.
West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker stated that the region's bus network is being franchised out of necessity due to failing services. Mr. Parker was questioned about his plans to bring bus services back into public control from the current private operator-led model at a West Midlands Combined Authority Joint Overview and Scrutiny Committee meeting. Coventry Councillor Pervis Akhtar expressed disquiet over the plans and asked for reassurances that the process will deliver the intended benefits. The Mayor revealed that the business sector urged him to sort out the bus network when he was campaigning prior to his election in 2024. Mr. Parker explained that moving towards a deregulated system would give Transport for West Midlands more control over fares, routes and timetables. West Midlands Combined Authority currently provides an annual subsidy of around £50 million to private operators, but this has failed to stop fare increases and service reduction. Councillor Akhtar said, "You are delivering on franchising, and also at the end of this month, West Midland Trains will be taken back into public control. How confident are you and your team that you will be able to deliver franchising and also on trains to deliver reliability, affordability and frequency? There is some disquiet even in this organisation, and it would be helpful if you tell us it will happen within time and within budget. And yes, it will make a difference to our communities and to our economy by taking these momentous steps to bringing franchising and trains back under public control." Mr. Parker said, "We are franchising the bus network out of necessity. The private sector operator has failed this region. They benefit from tens of millions of pounds through subsidies each year, and services are declining and not improving. When I was campaigning, I met communities across this region. I spoke to business groups, and the biggest plea to me was to do all I can to improve the bus network. The bus timetables don't run in any way to match or align to the shift patterns the employers need. The failure of our bus network undermines everything I want to do in terms of increasing opportunity. But franchising gives us a great opportunity to reframe the way in which buses work, to look at ways in which we can run the network, build a timetable that meets the needs of the West Midlands, and that is why we're doing it. We are making good progress. I'm confident with the team around me that we've got the budgets in place to deliver on it."
Shoppers have faced changes to how they access Coventry Market as the City Centre South project moves forward. Rover Road was closed from January the 12th. Access to Coventry Market is via Sherborne Arcade in the Lower Precinct Shopping Centre or Market Way. Both routes will stay open and accessible during the day and evening. Vehicles displaying disability badges will no longer be able to access Coventry Market via Rover Road. Drivers are advised to use nearby drop-off points and parking areas, such as West Orchard Car Park. Visitors are advised to use the alternative access points and parking options while Rover Road remains closed. Contractor Hill Group said they are committed to keeping Coventry Market thriving during the £450 million project. Anyone travelling to Coventry Market is advised to plan their journey and follow on-site signage. Work is well underway on City Centre South, which will deliver new shops, homes and leisure facilities, as previously reported. Stuart Bale, Project Director of the Hill Group, said, "We are working closely with Coventry Market to ensure it continues to thrive. It's an important and much-loved feature of the city, and we remain committed to supporting its long-term success while these changes are implemented."
Over a million people visited the Coventry Building Society Arena in 2025. It was a huge year for the stadium, which not only celebrated its 20th anniversary, but also finally came into the ownership of the football club it was built for. The year saw 1.2 million visitors, a 7% increase on numbers last year, with growth in live events, football attendances and casino visitors. It signalled a record year since the pandemic for visitors to the venue, which was brought under new ownership in August 2025. The venue has hosted 547 exhibitions, conferences, meetings, annual awards and dinners, and live events over the year. Live performances in the indoor arena from artists including Ed Sheeran, Bob Dylan and Tom Grennan attracted over 38,000 visitors to the venue. It is hoped figures for 2026 will be even stronger. No doubt this will be helped when Take That take over the arena for three nights later this year, and Coventry City continue its march towards the Premier League. Paul Michael, Managing Director at Coventry Building Society Arena, said, "It was another huge year for the venue, headlined by our 20th anniversary celebrations, new ownership and continued investment. We are operating in a challenging economic environment, but our performance shows the confidence that organisers, partners and audiences have in the venue. This has been reflected by more inquiries, events staying with us for longer, improved utilisation across our event spaces and more visitors coming through the doors. The growth comes at a key point with the transition to Coventry City ownership and the introduction of a refreshed commercial strategy which will provide long-term stability and a clear vision for future growth. It is an exciting time for the arena, and we are confident about the role we can continue to play in bringing new business, visitors and investments into the wider region, as Coventry's visitor economy continues to break records year on year. The on-site Grosvenor Casino also recorded a strong year, welcoming around 200,000 visitors, supported by the continued success of flagship events, including Goliath, the UK's largest live poker tournament. The arena's on-site Doubletree by Hilton Hotel saw occupancy rates, average room rates and revenue per available room remain stable. This was against the backdrop of a major refurbishment project, which saw all 121 bedrooms completed last year and is now focused on public areas in its final phase.
Tributes have been paid after a much-loved former Coventry Telegraph sports reporter died. John Wilkinson helmed the paper's coverage of Coventry Rugby Club for years and played a huge part in ensuring its survival. Her colleague said John, affectionately known as Wilkie, was so much more than just a rugby man, and his encyclopedic knowledge of all kinds of sports made him an important part of the paper and its sporting outlook. John had been battling cancer for a number of years, and he died aged 74 earlier this week. He came to Comedy Telegraph from the Northampton Evening Telegraph in 1989, initially covering rugby Lions, before taking over Coventry, before covering Coventry Rugby Club. He remained part of the local scene, writing about the club for the paper and its website, both in employed and freelance roles, for almost 30 years. Former Coventry Evening Telegraph sports editor Alan Poole said, "John was nominally the Telegraph's rugby union correspondent, but he was so much more than that. He raised our coverage of athletics, cycling and boxing in particular to new heights, and embraced numerous other so-called minority sports with astonishing energy and enthusiasm. In journalistic terms, he was the ultimate all-rounder. Long before we could just dial up facts on the internet, he had an astonishing trove of specialist knowledge at his fingertips. And he was a superb writer, an old-school craftsman who could knock out high-quality copy to length, however tight the deadline. Even more impressively, though, John didn't just cover local sport. He immersed himself in it, helping countless clubs and associations with free advice and administrative support. I worked with a lot of exceptionally talented journalists during my half-century in the trade, but I can't think of anyone who made such an impact on their adopted community. Coventry Rugby is deeply saddened by the passing of John Wilkinson and sends its sincere condolences to his family and friends," a club spokesman said. As a reporter with the Coventry Telegraph, John worked tirelessly with the rugby community and key contacts to help secure the future of the club we cherish today. His impact and dedication will always be remembered.
A visually impaired Coventry pensioner described his months-long ordeal of living in an insect-infested home as a living nightmare. Michael Jones has blasted Citizen Housing, accusing the provider of forgetting he existed. Michael, from Tile Hill, said that at the height of the infestation in August last year, he was forced to dispose of his sofa and chairs at the cost of £60. He then replaced the furniture through the British Heart Foundation. He was also required to meet half the cost of the infestation and forked out £300. Michael said his ordeal was only resolved after several phone calls and a formal letter from his GP. Michael said, "I am 71. I have poor sight. I live on my own. But it felt like Citizen Housing forgot I existed. I want the bosses at Citizen to see what it really is like here and admit they have failed us. We are not asking for much, just a safe place to live and a bit of respect." Although Citizen Housing initially claimed the matter was resolved in September, the infestation continued until November, leaving Michael extremely distressed. Now that the issue has been resolved, the 71-year-old said he feels badly let down. Councillor Gary Ridley stepped in after reading a letter from Mr. Jones's GP in August last year. Doctors had requested an immediate inspection and fumigation to prevent the problem from worsening. Councillor Ridley said, "Mr. Jones was forced to endure 19th-century living conditions in the year 2025. He was badly let down by the institutions that are supposed to protect him, and it is completely unacceptable." Head of Estates and Services at Citizen, Ellie Dick, said, "We are sorry for the distress Mr. Jones has experienced due to pests in his home. We were first alerted to the issue in late August 2025 and arranged an urgent visit from our pest control contractor."
Highways chiefs of the City Council have admitted that they cannot take action against able-bodied drivers parking in disabled bays on Coventry's roads. The news will disappoint more than 100 residents who signed a petition calling on the council to fine those who did not display a blue badge. The petition with 125 signatures was considered by the council. It said that many disabled people were suffering through the misuse of the bays and urged the council to penalise those at fault. But in their response, officers explained that there is little the local authority can do. The Cabinet Member for City Services, Councillor Patricia Heatherton, will be told at a meeting this week that the bays were just advisory.
A mum said she feared for her children's education after school strikes left them spending more time at home than in lessons. Faye Allen's son and daughter are amongst thousands of pupils across the Midlands caught up in industrial action, called over the threat of more than 100 job losses among teachers and support staff. The dispute was sparked by financial difficulties at the Arthur Terry Learning Partnership, which runs 24 schools across Birmingham, Coventry, Staffordshire and Warwickshire. 9 days of strike action by National Education Union members are planned for next month, on top of 9 currently underway this month. Faye's children attend one of 20 Midlands schools participating in strike action. Faye said, "As parents, we stand with teachers in the strike, but the impact this will have long term is much worse. If these strikes go ahead, my daughter will have been in school for 12 days this term, with 18 strike days, and my son will have been in school for 14 days, with 16 strike days. With two parents working and doing the best they can, it's been pretty awful for our children. My children don't know what's going on. They are confused about why they aren't in school and why they can't see their friends." The NEU, which has claimed the support of parents, said proposed redundancies were the result of financial mistakes at the trust. Announcing the first round of strikes last month, it said, "The NEU is hugely concerned that such large-scale redundancies will damage students' education, leading to larger class sizes, more workload for staff and less support for the children. Schools pay a whopping 20% of their total budget, the money that comes into the school for each child, to the trust for the central running of services, called a top slice. The NEU understands the average top slice for academies across the country is around 5%, yet last year the ATLP central spend was closer to 28%. A spokesman for the Arthur Terry Learning Partnership previously said, "We are committed to tackling the financial challenges we face so that we bring stability to the trust and schools as quickly as possible, while at the same time maintaining the high standards of education and care that our pupils and their families deserve and expect. Returning to a financially sustainable position means taking some difficult decisions. We continue to explore every area of expenditure and have identified numerous savings."
Police have warned of an increase in burglaries in Coventry and the 7 items thieves are on the lookout for. In one break-in, cash was stolen after thieves climbed through the bathroom window of a property on Stepping Stones Road in Cowden last week. Another property on nearby Oakfield Road was also targeted and cable wire stolen, according to Coventry Police. Police are also investigating an attempted burglary on Hornsey Close in Henley Green. Police warned that these were the items that they were being sought by thieves. They are cash, jewellery, family gold, designer goods, passports, credit cards and ID documents. A spokesman said, "We are seeing an increase in burglaries. If you have high-value items such as jewellery, watches, passports, credit cards and ID documents, you may want to consider storing them in a safe. Photograph your jewellery on a plain background with a ruler next to it to give an idea of size to help in its recovery for insurance purposes. Keep your windows and doors locked even when you're in. Check if criminals could access your upstairs window by climbing onto a garage roof or fence wall. Be cautious about sharing photos and videos of large amounts of cash, jewellery and designer goods on social media. Criminals are scouring social media platforms looking for easy targets. Our officers have been carrying out high visibility patrols, paying particular attention to areas that have been reported to have had a recent increase in crime or antisocial behaviour.
A new no-waiting ban has been unveiled for junctions at seven streets in Coventry. The plan has been revealed in a traffic order proposed by the City Council. It states that the council plans to introduce no waiting at any time restrictions at the junctions of Clara Street, Dean Street, Gresham Street, Hamilton Road, Harley Street, Kingsway and Marlborough Road. The order is proposed to improve vehicular access, specifically larger vehicles, and a more amenable and safer route for pedestrians accessing local amenities, the proposed order states. But the proposal will not become official until a public consultation is held. The plans can now be found on the Council's website as well as at the Council House in Earl Street.
Dog owners have been issued a stern warning that they could face unlimited fines under new laws implemented at the close of 2025. The government has introduced stringent regulations for pet owners whose animals attack or distress farm livestock as part of its Animal Welfare Strategy and the Dogs Protection of Livestock Amendment Act of 2025. In addition to the proposed of limitless fines, the law now empowers police to detain dogs perceived as a threat to livestock. Police are also authorised to enter properties to gather information on animal DNA, aiding in the prevention of future incidents. Courts can now order offenders to bear the costs associated with seizing and caring for a detained dog. Farming Minister Dame Angela Eagle commented, "Livestock worrying can have devastating consequences for farmers and their animals, with sheep, cows and other animals often suffering severe injuries, trauma or even death. These stronger protections will help keep livestock safe and give farmers more confidence that incidents can be quickly and properly investigated."
And the saga of the former NatWest Bank in Earlston Street continues. A Coventry councillor is demanding immediate action after the unauthorised demolition of the building. The former NatWest Bank in Earlston Street was partially knocked down over the Christmas period 2024. But over a year later, scaffolding and hoarding still hide what is left. Councillor Gary Ridley raised the issue at a recent council meeting. Cabinet Member for Housing and Communities, Councillor Naeem Akhtar, explained that statements and proofs of evidence had been exchanged and that the public consultation period for the appeal had ended. He added, "The appeal is currently with the Secretary of State and held in abeyance, awaiting the allocation of a planning inspector to determine the appeal. It is not appropriate to speculate on what further action may be taken until the outcome of the appeal is known." But Councillor Ridley has now written to the government demanding immediate action. The leader of the Conservative group on Coventry City Council said, "The site, situated in the Earlston Conservation Area, was demolished without authority in late 2024. Whilst the council correctly issued a stop notice, the subsequent appeal process has descended into an unacceptable state of bureaucratic inertia." He added, "For 7 months this case has been decision ready. There are no further documents to file and no more evidence to collect. The only reason for this delay is your department's failure to appoint a planning inspector. This seven-month period of total inactivity exceeds the national median for completing entire appeals. It is an insult to the law-abiding people of Coventry that a flagship heritage site has been left to rot due to an administrative backlog.
Outlook News.
So that concludes your local news for this week. Now, we've got a couple of announcements. Firstly, times, of course. Sunrise now is just 5 to 8, and in the evening it's staying up until 4 to 5, so days are getting longer. And I've got a message from the shop here. Anyone out there thinking of getting married? Because they now have a wedding dress and bridesmaids dresses, and they would love to find a good home for them. Then also got a special sale on. There are 5 CDs for just £1. So there's a bargain for you. So with that, we say, Hugh, you're in charge of this. Do you know about these giveaways they're giving away?
I tell you what, there's bridesmaids dresses. I mean, they're a vibrant, but actually very nice green, and they're sort of satiny and very lovely. And yep. Anyway, so they've got all sorts of lovely stuff in there. Always worth going for a visit. How the days are
getting longer
and everything. It just there was a I don't know whether anybody knows, there's a poet by the name of Brian Bilston who's very, very funny, and one of his poems is called Mnemonic. You might recognise where his inspiration comes from, but anyway, here it goes. 30 days hath September, April, June and November, unless a leap year is its fate, February hath 28, all the rest have 3 days more, excepting January, which has 6,184. And I do have this month has gone on quite a long time. It has to be said. Yes. Time
it's one of the worst months, I think.
Bleeding ate it. There we are.
So what's happening here?
So we've got. We've had a little bit of a response for our campaign to name the buses. So we have 3 names. If you fancy to sort of pick out some names for the buses, we will name the buses those. We'll decide which ones we like the best. And there might be a small prize for the person who comes up with the best names that we like the best. So,
would you like them related names?
Probably, yes.
A, B, and C,
yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But not A, B, and C. No, that's quite a bit dull. So put your thinking caps on for that. XYZ, yeah, exactly. Talking of which, our newest to us, but the oldest bus that we have now, our brand new little Renault, that's going off to have all its livery done this week. So by the time you get this, it should be fully badged with Coventry Vision Hub and everything. So that should be a very good thing. We're looking forward to that. This is a little late, it has to be said, this next item of news. We're about 3.5 months late with it. But nevertheless, it's something that's still going on. So Be My Eyes, which is one of these AI apps that you have on your phone, which connects you either to AI or to a volunteer anywhere in the world for free. They will read things for you and describe scenes for you and what have you. But they've teamed up with Tesco. And they're doing to make in-store shopping more accessible across the UK. And it's a partnership that lets blind and partially sighted customers connect with trained Tesco staff through the Be My Eyes app for real-time personalised visual support while they shop. So this actually started in October last year, and it's on a 6-month pilot. So you've still got a few, 2.5 months or so to go with it. So Be My Eyes and Tesco are rolling out direct in-store assistance. And it's accessible directly through the Be My Eyes service on the app. And you can reach Tesco colleagues who can help identify the right products, confirm sizes and variants, check expiry dates, and find items more easily through the store. They say for many in our community, grocery shopping can involve guesswork, extra trips or waiting for assistance. And this collaboration is about removing those barriers by bringing on-demand support directly into the shopping experience, Tesco supporting its customers using the Be My Eyes app. So what shoppers can expect, so support is available on demand through the Be My Eyes app, so there's no need to wait for a colleague on the floor or to change how shopping normally happens. The goal is simple, faster, more confident shopping with fewer hurdles along the way. Through Be My Eyes, blind and partially sighted Tesco customers can get live assistance with product identification to confirm the exact item, flavour or size needed. Quick checks on special offers, promotions and club card loyalty rewards to ensure the best value at checkout. And using the self-service checkouts and other in-store touch points. To get started, all you need to do is to download or open the Be My Eyes app from the App Store and Google Play, and it's a free app. You can select service directory, navigate to food and drinks, and choose the Tesco support option when shopping in store. And then that will connect you directly live with a Tesco agent for quick assistance. That's it. There's no additional setup required. You can connect to the service on demand right when you need it and get real-time guidance from trained Tesco colleagues, whether it's checking product details or exploring offers. This support allows customers to shop independently, efficiently and with confidence, making everyday errands simpler and more inclusive.
So I understand it, because I'm not quite clear. You access the app, then what actually physically happens? Anything?
Well, you've got your phone.
A person comes or not?
No, a person doesn't come. No,
so you operate through the camera. You describe the goods you're trying to find or what?
It operates through the camera on your phone. So pointing
your phone. Point your phone camera
at the thing that you're trying to identify, and they will help you navigate through it.
Excellent.
So you know, I know a lot of people out there in listener land are Tesco customers, and you might want to go to Tesco yourself.
Regardless, I mean now,
So
right, we need somebody to try this out and report back.
Yes, absolutely. And
Chris hasn't done it yet.
Not as far as I'm aware. No. He might be a Sainsbury's shopper. I know I am. So, but if anybody out there, you know, does like going into Tesco and fancies giving it a go, we would be really, really interested to know how that goes for you.
Interesting development. Though,
it is
very
much
so.
So we've got a fundraiser coming up. So this very coming Sunday, which is the 1st of February, there is down in Long Itchington. So I know a couple of people living in Long Itchington at the Harvester Inn. In the evening, we've got a fundraising concert at Willow and Tools Music Parlour. Now, Willow... just trying to remember his first name, actually. He's actually got a visual impairment himself, he's a big name in the
folk music
in Coventry, and also playing at this concert will be Casey Jones. Now Casey Jones is Karen and Colin Jones, and Karen, as many of you will know, is our superb outreach officer, and many of you have had some support from Karen. She and Colin are terrific, and so definitely worth coming along. Also, we've got Yonderland, which might be a certain Mr. Monks Jr. As well. So there's all sorts of things.
Graham Monks. Actually.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is Graham. Yeah. So there's lots going on there. So it's a free admission, but there is a banknote collection in aid of us. I'm going to be there, and just to talk a little bit about the charity. I've promised to keep it under 2 hours.
No, not 6,000 days.
Yeah, 6,000 days. Yeah, no, it's. I'll just talk for a few minutes about the charity.
What time is it?
So it's 7:30 PM, Sunday, the 1st of February, at the Harvester Inn, which is on Church Road in Long Itchington.
But there's no minibus.
No, you'd have to make your own way there. But you know, get some. You know,
friends and relations along.
Friends and relations to come along, and you know, and also put money in the bucket. That would
absolutely
be wonderful.
Right. I like the thing about it was a note collection.
Yes, a banknote collection.
Yes, I like that. Yes. I've never heard that expression
Yes,
before.
It's quite good. I used to, many years ago, people know that I do quite a lot of theatre, but over in Norwich, where I used to live, we used to do theatre in the parks, and it was all free and everything, but we used to hand a bucket round afterwards. We'd get far more money than if we'd actually sort of sold tickets.
Really?
Yeah, yes. People were very generous. Yeah, it's a very good way of doing things.
Yes.
I've mentioned this before, but the physical exercise class, the physical training class that happens on Wednesday is not happening on the 18th of February, which is a couple of weeks' time. Is that right? Yes. So just be aware if you attend that class. I just wanted to sort of update you as well. Karen and I, yesterday, we went to Victoria Manor Care Home, which is a care home in Whitley Village. And we offered some training there for the first time. You know, we've developed a training package for care homes to raise awareness about issues of visual impairment. So we're training staff in how to do sighted guiding properly, what to be aware of, the impact of sight loss on people, and you know, how they can better support people with sight loss who live in care homes. It went off very well, actually. It was our very first tryout with this, and we think it went well. So we're going to be rolling this out to other care homes. There will be a charge associated for the care homes. It'll be part of their training. If you happen to live in a care home and you think that the staff could do with a bit of training, certainly it might be worth mentioning it to your manager, that saying that we're offering this course. It's a 1.5 hours to 2 hour training session on sight loss, and the care homes can just approach us and we will book them in.
Contact you.
Yes, anyone, contact me or anyone. Karen, okay. Yes, here at the centre. The telephone number, as many of you will know, is 024-6717522. And the cost to the care homes is £300 a time. So, we hope it'll be a good earner for us. We know that we've got several care homes already lined up for the training. But it's a slightly new thing that we're doing. I went to talk to Forum for Care Home Providers a little while ago, and they were all eager for this training to be available. So that's what it is now.
Good.
Okay, and I think that's it. I'm going to be on holiday in half term. So
when is half term?
It's the Friday is the 20th.
So three weeks today. Yes. Or 3 weeks this week, basically.
So if you,
and you're away for how long?
Just for that week. So if you're
to where?
Oh no, not going anywhere.
Oh, aren't you?
As it happens, my husband Robert, lucky man, is retiring.
Oh, is he?
Week. So we're just going to sort of
potter and do things.
And that was me thinking you were going to be doing the decorating.
No, that's all going to be him. He's got plenty of time.
He's okay about that, is he?
Yes. No,
doesn't he know yet?
Well, no, he does know. He does know about it because he started it. We have a whole bedroom that is basically back to the brickwork at the moment. So he's got to carry on with that.
Good.
So anyway, that is it for the moment.
Good. Thanks, Hugh.
Thank you.
Now it's time for Sarah to give a roundup of the last week's sporting highlights.
Hello, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. Now, I'm going to have to struggle a little bit this week because my phone isn't working. So I'm having to record this on my iPad, where also is my script. Hey ho, we'll get through it together, you know we will. Now, last week, on a wet, cold Tuesday evening, Coventry entertained Millwall at home. Now, Millwall had very much been billed as the team of the moment, having won most of their matches, whereas City, as you know, have had a bit of a rough Christmas. Anyway, all that changed in the 11th minute, when the ball was scrambled just over that goal line, and much to the Millwall goalkeeper's annoyance, the ref gave the goal because the goal line technology had bleeped on his watch to say it had crossed the line. So City led 1-0, and what made it even better for us was that goal was scored by our new loanee, Roman Esse, who's on loan from Crystal Palace, having been sold by Millwall at the end of last season for a cool £14 million. Anyway, pride goes before a fall, and unfortunately it was all cancelled out when they scored just before half-time. But no despair, City fans. City had the last laugh when Hadji Wright nudged home his 10th goal in the league of the season to make it 2-1. And much as Millwall tried in the dying minutes of the match, that is how it finished. So, we were still top of that league, ahead of Middlesbrough, Ipswich and Millwall, though Ipswich do have a game in hand. Now, meanwhile, down the road in Leamington, they were losing 1-0 at half-time when their floodlights packed up. So that would have been at about 8:30. Anyway, the crowd all sat in the cold wind with no lights at all till 10 p.m. when the match was postponed. But that made me think, isn't that a way of when you're losing, getting a match cancelled and scrubbed out so you can have another go? Well, I'm sure the league would suss that one out too long. So, fast forwarding to Saturday, because as you know, Coventry weren't playing until Monday. Our boys in blue, in pale blue, Coventry rugby team, resumed their season in the Champ. Yes, it is called the Champ, not the Championship. Now, on Saturday, they travelled down to Bedford. Bedford Blues, I think, to give them their full name, who are currently in second place, whereas Cover in fourth, or were in fourth. Given that away a little bit, haven't I? Anyway, unfortunately, they were leading at half-time, but as they've done so many times this year, they threw it away in the second half and were the wrong end of a 38-31 points scoreline. Now, this coming Saturday, I know they're at home to Chinner, but I don't unfortunately have a start time for that. And then back to Leamington. Well, I'm delighted to say they picked up their first win in 17 games. And it was mostly thanks to goals in stoppage time. But they won 2-1, so well done, Leamington. So, Monday night, we travelled down south and across a bit to Norwich to take on the Canaries. Now, prior to that match, we hadn't got a particularly good record. Actually, Sarah, reword that. We got an atrocious record. We haven't actually won at Carrow Road for 17 years. Oh, surely with Lampard that will change. Well, I'm sorry to report that Monday night proved to be a bad day at the office for City. I would say that Norwich were on top pretty much from the outset, but nonetheless, City managed to go in 1-0 up at half-time thanks to a lovely goal from Romain Essé. You know, that guy we've got on loan from Crystal Palace. That happened 7 minutes before half-time, so we were on quite a bounce at half-time. But then, unfortunately, I think it was about 37 seconds into the second half, Norwich equalised, and then they scored again later on in the second half. So the final score was Norwich 2, Coventry 1. I mean, we're sort of a bit down at the moment because we dream of when our lead was 12 points, but we knew that we would hit a bad patch, and we are pulling ourselves out of it. It's sort of great to see that so many of the long-term injuries have come back to playing, although most of them haven't regained the form that they had before they were injured. In particular, Jack Redoni, who wasn't even on the starting side or the bench last night. But we are still 3 points at the top of the league. Oh, and our next match is against Queen's Park Rangers at Loftus Road, QPR's home ground, on Saturday. I believe it's a 3 p.m. start time. So, Turning to national sport, the Australian Open continues. And as I told you last week, there were three Brits who got from the first round into the second round. Emma Raducanu, Arthur Ferry and Cameron Norrie. Well, that was as far as it got because I'm afraid we had five other Brits in the first round on the following day, but none of them made it. And then, sadly, Emma Raducanu and Arthur Ferry were knocked out in the second round. And Cameron Norrie was unfortunate to meet Alexander Zverev in the third round. Now, Zverev is seeded three, and our Cameron lost. Come on, Jack Draper, we need you back from injury. And finally, now I told you last week about the heat in Australia that the players were going to face. Well, it nearly took its toll on our Jannik Sinner. The world number one was one set and one game down when he was looking desperate to his coach, to the referee, to the umpire. And fortunately, and I suspect because it was the world number one, they took some notice. And at that point, with the sun directly on the courts and the temperature registering 36 degrees, they cancelled all play outdoors, closed the roof on the show courts, and Sinner was able to continue and he ran out the winner in four sets. By the way, I should just say at this point, the show courts, of course, have air conditioning. Sublime to the ridiculous, really. And finally, because I know you're all salivating with joy and looking forward to these two events, the men's Six Nations rugby begins on Thursday the 5th of February. And the Winter Olympics begins on Friday the 6th. You know, that event where we all suddenly discover curling as our new national sport. Well, maybe not. Anyway, that's been your sport this week, lovely, lovely listeners. And I hope to speak to you next week. Bye.
Thanks, Sarah. And now, following sport as ever, here's Dave with your postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello, welcome to your postbag. Now we begin by welcoming new postbag contributor, Graham Hover. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. Anyway, here's a New Year greeting from Graham.
Well, this is Graham Homer. I am leaving a message for the postbag and also to wish everybody at the Hub a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and to your readers, or listeners, I suppose you should say. I'm a newcomer. I joined earlier this year, and I'm very thankful I did. I've had a lot of help from Hugh and staff, and I would like to convey my thanks to everybody there for all the assistance I've had since joining. And I wish everybody, again, a Merry Christmas and a very happy and healthy New Year. Thank you.
Thanks, Graham. It's great to hear from you. Now you've made that first step to phone in a message on that postbag answer phone, please don't stop now and keep on sending in messages throughout the year, letting us know of your progress and how the resource centre's helping you. What things do you do in life? So, what did you have for Christmas? Now here's Graham Whale to tell you about a really helpful personal service. If you need help reading your correspondence or magazines, the Coventry Reader Service for the Blind.
Well, it's a new year and time to think ahead and new ways of doing things and improving your life. Why not consider a reader from the Coventry Reader Service for the Blind and Partially Sighted? They're very carefully selected. They have to provide two referees. They have to be police checked. I can't remember the terminology now. And they have to go online and complete several courses, which the insurance company insists on. There's a lot of hoops they have to climb through these days to volunteer for the reader service. But one thing is sure, they can be relied on. Certainly more than some of my relatives, anyway. Anyway, if you fancy having the reader from the reader service, you can call Linda Brody on 02476 417741. That's 02476 417741. Or 07966 756 693. I'll repeat that and get it right this time, I hope. 07966 756 693. And if it's not too late, a happy new year.
Thank you, Graham. So get on board with that. It's a very helpful service. So ring Linda Brody on 02476 417741. And there were volunteers in Coventry just waiting for someone to read to. So don't think that you don't want to trouble them, because, as Graham says, they've jumped through hoops to get referees to vouch for them. And if they don't have anyone to read to, they might just get fed up with waiting and take up something else. So phone Linda Brody again on 02476 417741. And here's another simple solution to a problem. Edwina tells you about how to feel your bank card in your wallet or purse from any other cards.
Hi, everybody. Are you one of the big spenders in the sales? If you are, you need to keep your payment card handy. What I've got is an elastic band round mine, so that when I feel in my purse for the payment card, I find it immediately. I thought it might help some of you. Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina, for another helpful tip. Simply put an elastic band round your bank card, and then you'll be able to discern it from all the other cards in your purse or wallet. Simple, isn't it? And these tips don't cost you anything. And if you have any simple, helpful tips, please share them with your fellow listeners. The start of the year is the time to celebrate the old English tradition of wassailing the apple trees. Elizabeth went along to Wolseley Hall, Wall Garden, where two trees were decorated with tinsel as the King Tree and the Queen Tree. Master of Ceremonies, Tim Clay, then placed a piece of toast soaked in cider on the branches of the trees to attract the robins and ensure a good harvest. Everybody then goes around with saucepans and bashing them with wooden spoons. Tim Clay recited the wassailing poem.
Here's to thee, young apple tree, whence thou mayest bud and whence thou mayest blow, and whence thou mayest bear apples enow. Hats full, caps full, bushel, bushel, sacks full, and my pockets full too. Huzzah! Wassail, wassail, wassail!
Hi everybody. This weekend we attended wassailing at Wolseley Hall Walls Garden, an event which is held annually. During the festivities, the Sherborne Choir sing old English songs. Morris dancers perform, clashing large sticks. The Wykin Pippin trees are anointed to promote a good harvest this year. Hot cider is consumed by one and all, whilst making merry. A very convivial occasion. The revellers we included, march around the garden banging our saucepans with our wooden spoons. Most enjoyable.
Here we come, the wassailing among the leaves so green. Here we come, the wandering so fair to be seen. Love and joy come to you, and to you your wassail too. And God bless you and send you a happy new year. And God send you a happy new year.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's great to keep celebrating these old customs. And wassailing is great fun. And did you know, for instance, there's an ancient superstition regarding the 20th of January, the eve of Saint Agnes. It was thought that if a young woman went to bed without eating supper, lay on her back and slept with her hands under the pillow, she would dream of a future husband. So there you are. Do you know of any other superstitions no longer practiced, or maybe some are? Okay, thank you for your messages this week. We'd love to hear how you're getting on. Have you made any New Year's resolutions? Have you kept them or broken them? Do you have any helpful tips to pass on to your fellow listeners? Remember, these tips are often free. Okay. So what plans do you have for the new year? Any thoughts arising from any of the items on Outlook, including the news? Ring that number, that dreaded postbag number people seem to be scared of. It's 02476 717 522, and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper, and just start speaking. If you make any mistakes, we can chop them out. We have the technology. Okay, thank you, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's your postbag until next week. Now, despite rather inclement weather, Elaine continues her tour of Warwickshire villages, and this week she's in Princethorpe.
Princethorpe, possibly known best for its school. No, not a romantic prince, but probably an Anglo-Saxon farmer called Pren. The name has been known for 800 years. Joseph Elkington of Stretton was awarded £1,000 by Parliament in 1795 for his new land drainage system. That would have been an awful lot in today's money. Hitherto, open drains were used in the fields, despite their interference with cultivation. Elkington drained a field in Princethorpe to show how wet marginal land could be made productive, a necessary step in the agricultural revolution. The government hastened with the payment in case all knowledge of his original 1764 discovery died with him, as he was in precarious health. From the award was founded the family firm of Elkingtons, the famous silversmiths. I wonder what that's got to do with draining a field. Early in the 20th century, the village was much more self-contained and self-sufficient than it is today. Men worked on their own farms and small holdings or for other farmers, including the priory. An unusual feature of the village was the woman chimney sweep, who travelled round the locality carrying her equipment on her bicycle. Ghost stories are common, but strangely, none of the ghosts haunted Coffin Walk between Princethorpe and the parish church at Stretton, which traditionally was maintained at 5 feet, that is, the width of a coffin and the bearers. This path forks to the shoulder of Mutton in Stretton. Perhaps the bearers came back that way. The outstanding building is the Priory Church, added by Peter Paul Pugin in 1897, its fine red brick tower is a landmark. The site was acquired by a group of French Benedictine nuns from Montaris, who in 1792 escaped from the French Revolution, helped by Mrs. Fitzherbert, the Prince Regent's wife. The nuns had been forced by a bad storm to land at Shoreham, and the prince himself thoughtfully sent carriages from Brighton for them. He arranged overnight lodging and ordered travelling cloaks for their journey to Norfolk, where they had been lent a house. In gratitude, the nuns have ever since sung a daily prayer for the sovereign. After several moves, the nuns bought land at Princethorpe in 1832 and settled there in the new building with their school. The bricks were made of clay dug on site and fired nearby. A reservoir was built there and later artistically landscaped to resemble a small lake at Montargis and was christened Little Switzerland. The building of the Pugin Church brought hundreds of sightseers every weekend to watch progress. In 1965, the Benedictine nuns sold the priory to the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart, who then converted it into the independent Catholic school, Princethorpe College, still going strong today. The Second World War saw several small factories in the village making supplies for the forces and civil defence. Entertaining the forces was both a duty and a pleasure. Caravans, spare rooms, and even outhouses were crowded with Coventrians seeking relief from the nightly bombing. The early 1950s were an exciting time in Princethorpe. Roman coins were found near Stonyford Bridge, where previous finds had included an Anglo-Saxon brooch and an iron spearhead. The notorious Princethorpe bank robber was thought to have buried his loot by his house in Nuns Wood, but nobody has been lucky enough to find it. The new road was made then so that pedestrians no longer had to dodge the refuges cut into the steep banks on either side of the old narrow Coventry-Oxford Road near the Three Horseshoes, a defile often known as the Khyber Pass. The old college farm buildings, the manor house barns and the old manor house farm and buildings have been converted into accommodation for newcomers to the village, providing homes for at least 14 families. Today there is no longer a working farm in Princethorpe, and the remaining acreage is farmed by farmers from neighbouring villages and part-time smallholders. Princethorpe College and the two hotels provide work for many of the women, but otherwise Princethorpe is now a dormitory village, even though many of the old families still live there.
From Princethorpe, Elaine travels to Pryde's Hardwick next week. Despite receiving life-changing injuries from an accident, Catherine Robinson is very positive and is full of hope and plans for her future. This is the first of a two-part article written by Andrea Busfield in the Daily Express and read by Margaret.
When Catherine Robinson set up her own horse training school 2 years ago, she fulfilled a long-held dream built on hard work, trust and instinct, all qualities that define her relationship with her equine charges. Having left school age 16 to work in a racing yard near Belfast, she had been obsessed with horses for half her life. Now she was building a rewarding and commercial career in the world she adored, with the animals she loved. Her future seemed full and enriching. But in the literal blink of an eye, the 34-year-old's life as she knew it changed irrevocably. During an ordinary day at work, she suffered catastrophic damage to her face when a 3-year-old gelding kicked her below the visor of her riding helmet. The horse's unexpected strike shattered her nose and both her eye sockets. In an instant, she was blinded. Catherine says, "Both my eye sockets, cheekbone and nose were shattered. My face resembled a crumpled bag of crisps." Surgeons at Coventry Hospital reconstructed her face, but eye specialists have since told her she will never regain her vision. The news would have devastated most people, but not Catherine. Even though she faces months of surgeries and rehabilitation, she's already looking to the future with renewed positivity. Her new dream? To compete at the Paralympics. It's a show of incredible bravery and determination. Until the accident on October the 27th, Catherine had been running her own business, breaking and backing young horses, teaching a horse to wear tack and to carry someone on their back. It is one of the most dangerous and highly skilled branches of the equestrian world. Based at a yard near Southam in Warwickshire, she took in youngsters from professional equestrian firms and private owners, transforming them from barely halter-broke colts and fillies into confident riding horses in a matter of weeks. "I love the challenge of young horses," she explains. "Every one of them is different, and it's so rewarding when it all goes well. You can have a horse you can't even get a head collar on, and in 6 weeks it's cantering round a field and popping jumps. There's nothing quite like it." The Monday morning of the accident started like any other at the beginning of the working week. The horses had enjoyed a quiet weekend, and Catherine led a new arrival, a three-year-old gelding, on only its second lunging session, as it's called, into the round pen. "I'd shut the gate behind me and turned to send him out on the circle," she recalls. "Instead of going from me, he came towards me. He just whizzed past and kicked out. It was a split second. I felt the blow on the side of my face and instantly everything went black." Knowing she was in trouble and amazingly still conscious, Catherine called for her assistant, 30-year-old Melissa Stone. "I couldn't see," she remembers. "The horse was still cantering around me and I couldn't get out or reach my phone." Melissa got the horse out and called the ambulance and just stayed with me. For 45 minutes, Catherine lay in the lunge pen waiting for paramedics to arrive. Even then, she remained conscious and talking. "I knew straight away my face was split open," she says, with a courageous matter-of-factness. "But I honestly thought the blindness was swelling. It didn't cross my mind that it could be permanent." At the hospital, however, scans confirmed the devastating truth. "My left eye was completely destroyed and the right was leaking fluid," she continues. "They said it was a catastrophic injury." 3 days after the accident, Catherine underwent emergency surgery lasting 5 hours to repair her nose and stem leakage from her right eye. 2 days after that, specialists broke the news that she had feared most. Both her eyes were beyond saving. "I'm quite a tough person, but it's still hard to hear," she says quietly. "Everyone around me was devastated, but I just kept thinking, I'm lucky to be here. If it had been a head-on kick, I probably wouldn't be." Her parents flew over from Northern Ireland to be by her bedside, joining her partner Jack, a 27-year-old digger driver. "Jack's been amazing," she says. "He's positive and funny and keeps me going. There'll be tough days, but we'll take each one as it comes." Friends converted her living quarters to make them safer. Melissa placed her clothes in a specific place so she can dress herself each morning, and bought an alarm that tells Catherine when to stop pouring water from the kettle into her teacup. "My house is small and I know it quite well, which has helped," says Catherine. But the way it is set out means we have to go out of the house and up some stairs to get to the bedroom. At first, Jack and I discussed sleeping downstairs, but then he told me I could do it, and together we counted the 13 steps up and 13 steps down, so it is all fairly easy.
And Margaret will conclude Catherine's story next week. Now, last week, you'll remember, Bill started the story of Alistair Wood, who always knew his family was different. And from the papers his father left to his mother, he discovered a lot about his family history. This is the conclusion of an article written by Charlotte Heathcote in the Daily Express.
Alistair believes his father's background explains his idiosyncrasies. In childhood, he never stayed anywhere more than 6 months. In adult life, he never really stayed anywhere more than 2 years. He'd wandered round the world and had the perfect background for a frontline agent, his incredible linguistics. JWB spoke 16 languages, and his previous wife, Dorothy McLean, thought he was Norwegian until he produced a British passport en route to their honeymoon in Buenos Aires. But most importantly, he was an expert radio operator, continues Alistair. On the other hand, he was a pacifist vegetarian, one of the early hippies, so he was the most unlikely spy. Alistair does not wish that JBW had been a more hands-on father. I knew him from afar, in the sense he was always talked about. I liked him. He was a larger-than-life character. But he was a walking disaster area, really. Normal rules didn't apply. And what you never had, you never miss. I had a happy childhood and a terrific stepfather. So JBW was this absent, distant figure, which in a way added to his mystique. But when JBW had walked out on his family, he'd made no provision for financial support, and it fell to Margaret to hold everything together. And here the true hero of the story begins to emerge. It was extremely tiring for her, having to juggle everything, having to work and bring up 2 kids. It must have been a hell of a struggle, but she shielded us from most of it. Margaret spent 5 years doing dull, clerical work for the SIS. It came as a relief when they offered her an administrative job and accommodation at the fort, as the SIS training facility was known. That solved all her financial problems. And finally, we could have an ice cream on holiday, smiles Alistair. But his new address had its downsides. He was 13 when they moved to the fort, but he couldn't tell school friends where he lived, and inviting visitors was out of the question. It was ingrained in me from a very early age never to talk about it, he says. For Alistair, the setting evoked J.G. Ballard's Empire of the Sun, the story of a boy in a prisoner of war camp. Though he wasn't unhappy there once the family had settled in, he spent most of his spare time cycling around and exploring the surrounding countryside. It was also at the fort that Margaret met her second husband, her boss, and an ex-marine. While Alistair's book primarily recounts what he could piece together of his father's astonishing, globe-trotting adventures, he emphasizes, "My mother was a much more interesting character than my father was, so I wanted to get across my mother's unreported contribution." Margaret came from an ordinary background in Whitley Bay and was recruited to SIS by her aunt Agnes Miller, an associate of Kim Philby. She was 20 when she was dispatched to Berlin, a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed youngster. She volunteered for everything. Most of the people my mother knew wouldn't have known much about her history. She didn't think much of it. She just saw herself as a secretary who would occasionally be asked to put the top back on a typewriter and help out a bit. His mother died of cancer in 1990, and Harold Shergold, said to be the inspiration for John le Carré's George Smiley, gave a eulogy at her funeral. Shergi was, by a very long way, the most important person in the history of SIS, and to give the eulogy was pretty remarkable, because she'd been passing herself off as a secretary. And at the funeral, he publicly denounced my father. The family speculated that Margaret had cut short her own suffering by suicide, and Alistair was reminded of the cyanide pill he had glimpsed when he was just very young, kept in the small velvet box that contained her wedding ring. Both equally deadly, she told him dryly. He later saw it tucked into the back of an underwear drawer at the fort. I don't know the truth of it, but I'm pleased for her if she did, because she had a very difficult, drawn-out death, he notes. Alistair drew upon a rich trove of papers and letters to write his book. When JBW's mother died, she bequeathed everything to her grandsons, and since JBW had deposited all his private papers in a safety deposit box under her name, they now belonged to Alistair. And there was nothing that a very angry JBW, who wrote stroppy letters, could do about it. JBW's personal archive gave the truth to the lie he was telling all the time. He wanted it back. So I was suddenly persona non grata. But even at 21, I knew he was unlikely to make much contact with us again. So I had to keep hold of what I had. Alistair also draws on details from his mother's letters to his aunt Agnes. That gave us a running commentary to events that, at the time, I was completely shielded from. For all the tantalising gaps in his parents' fascinating stories, what Alistair has uncovered proves that old adage that truth is far, far stranger than fiction.
What a fascinating story. I think we can all recall memories of our school days and school trips. Danny Thompson has written about school trips in the 1990s in the Coventry Telegraph, and her memories are read by Elaine.
We all remember the excitement of a school trip. No lessons, no stuffy classroom. Just you and your mates and a day out, which nearly always started by getting on a minibus or a coach. We didn't realise it at the time, but for lots of us, these fondly remembered school trips became nostalgic memories from our days in education, and city schools had some fantastic educational attractions to wow pupils. If you grew up in Coventry, there is a good chance you went to one of the below-mentioned trips, maybe even all of them. So pick a partner, hold hands, and get ready for a school trip down memory lane. The first one, Plas Dolly Mock. This adventure site was basically the ultimate school trip for Coventry kids, and the city schools have been visiting it for more than 50 years. Visiting Plas Dolly Mock in the valleys of northwestern Wales gave kids a chance to have a go at abseiling, kayaking, mountain walking, and much more. If you went, it was probably at the same time as kids from another Coventry school, and more than likely you competed with them to see who was the best and gave each other dirty looks in the dining area. You probably also had to clear spiders out of the kayaks before you could use them. You may also have engaged in pillow fights and told ghost stories after lights out, the latter possibly leaving you too scared to use the loo at night because you'd been told by an older sibling or a kid in the year above Dolly Mock was definitely haunted. But above all, you had fun and spent time away without parents, probably for the first time in your life. The second one, the Lunt Roman Fort. This site in Baginton was formerly an ancient fortress used during Roman times, and you may have gone here with your school while learning about the Roman Empire. The fort sits on a high plateau with a steep wooded slope overlooking the River Sau. The site's defensive situation and its proximity to a crossing point in the river made it an ideal location for a Roman fort. Archaeological investigations have uncovered small amounts of Roman armour and horse equipment, suggesting that cavalry units were stationed at the Lunt. The third one, Coventry Cathedral. One of the benefits, if living in Coventry, is having an actual piece of history right in the centre of our city. This school trip often included a visit to both old and new cathedrals on the same day, and learning about the history of both sites. I always remember being disappointed we weren't allowed to climb the steps of the spire to look out on the city, but looking back, it made perfect sense. A few adults taking 30 kids up a narrow winding staircase with over 180 steps to what is basically a 300-foot drop must break a fair few health and safety regulations. Many children were also drawn to the graphic depiction of the angel Gabriel banishing a defeated Lucifer from heaven. The huge statue attached to the wall round the back of the new cathedral was interesting in lots, if different, ways. Kenilworth and Warwick Castles. Having two castles fairly close by meant they were a regular destination for school trips for Coventry kids. Though Warwick Castle is beautifully maintained, visiting the ruins of Kenilworth Castle in the 1990s meant immersive experiences for the children. These incredible workshops would see children assigned roles for the day, such as baker, soldier, or beggar, and they would spend the day doing that role. These experiences were a fun way to learn, gave a real insight into how people lived hundreds of years ago. Meanwhile, Warwick Castle had stunning birds of prey, a grand great hall, beautiful grounds, and ornate turrets, plus a spooky suit of armour or two. And the last visit, Coventry Transport Museum. This one was fun for those who like cars and learning about the World Wars. Back in the 1990s, the museum had an incredibly haunting Blitz experience, complete with an air raid shelter, sirens, and these creepy-looking life-size models dressed in 1940s gear. It was pretty harrowing for a 9-year-old. However, there was also a series of incredible vehicles, including a copy of Marty McFly's time-travelling DeLorean, various fighter craft from World War II, and land speed record-breaking cars Thrust SSC and Thrust II. The museum also pays homage to the city's integral role in the cycle and motor industries, with visitors able to see early cycles, bicycles and cars from former Coventry motor heavyweights, Daimler, Humber and Standard.
So what do you recall about your school days and trips out? Let us hear your memories in a message in Dave's postbag. Now, the ruins of Kenilworth Castle have interesting history, particularly about Robert Dudley, who was almost bankrupted by the cost of Queen Elizabeth I's visit. And Dave visited the castle recently and found out more about Dudley's wooing of the Queen.
Hello, that's the sound of pigeons, and we're in Kenilworth Castle. Great, fascinating old building, isn't it, Graham?
Yeah.
It's changed a bit since we were last here.
Yeah.
It's got some, it's got some steps in place now. Yeah, so we're able to get up and see where the Queen Elizabeth I slept. Yeah, Robert Dudley Earl of Leicester, the Queen's favourite, invited Queen Elizabeth I to Kenilworth Castle for a 19-day party. And she was greeted by the Lady of the Lake, presenting her with the keys to the castle, because the grassy area behind the castle, with a dip in the middle, was actually an artificial lake then. And there was fireworks as well. Must have been a fantastic party. Right, so have you found anything interesting, Graham?
Yeah, the room we're in now was formerly a long room. On 17th of July, 1575, from her window at the far end, Elizabeth was able to watch the Coventry Men form play in the base court.
Oh, yes. Local performers from Coventry. Fantastic. It shows an ancient battle between Britons and Danes, and ending with the capture of the Danish army by British women. But the Queen was easily distracted by the delectable dancing inside the room, which she found much more entertaining. She commanded the Coventry men to return 2 days later. They staged the play again, at which she laughed well and rewarded them with gifts of venison and coins. I am standing in the first room of the Queen's most private apartments. The outer chamber stood before the door into the Queen's bedchamber. It was here that Elizabeth met with her closest friends and courtiers. Oh, where are we now, Graham? Echoey.
We're in the keep. That's where we are.
We're in the keep. And there's a big drop over this barrier. And that's the sound of the pigeons. Right, so how did the castle become a ruin, Graham?
It was slightly or deliberately destroyed in the 1640s in the Civil War.
Here in the big hall, there are sculptures. Various characters. These characters in medieval dress and pig faces and dog faces. What's your name, please?
Hello, it's Carl.
And I'm you're here working for English Heritage.
And we've just worked with the art installation of Linda Mendick's artwork, which is commemorating Elizabeth being here from the 9th of July, 1575. And it combines all the episodes of her life and also with also Greek mythology as well. And it's based in the undercroft of the Great Hall, which in its day was regarded as the most beautiful and largest room outside that of Westminster. Yes. And this is a marvellous setting for the sculpture, because the finish of the settings and the glazing of the ceramics for it fits beautifully in the surroundings of the lichen on the walls and the weathering of the stone of the castle itself. So it's like a secret garden almost, or a stage set for an Elizabethan masked ball to start. So it's very, very evocative, very, very beautifully done. And of course, in the setting was you've got the fragmented history, fragmented castle, it's all here. It's very, very enjoyable. It's very, very tactile as well, if you want to look at it as well, from that viewpoint as well.
Elizabeth I and Robert Dudley, who owned Kenilworth, became friends when they were children. Robert wanted to marry Elizabeth. When she visited him in 1575, he spent a lot of money trying to impress her. Carl, can you tell me about the kind of reasoning behind the artist and doing these sculptures?
It was to commemorate Elizabeth I coming here in 1575 for 19 days, and the artist is Linda Mendick. She was trained at the Royal College, and she spent 2 years working and thinking of the concept for this, which is carried out in ceramics, and the glazing of the ceramics are natural, unglazed, and they've just been naturally fired, but the texture of the firing has brought out the castle morph, because it's fragments of history, fragments of sculpture, and the artist wanted also to show that these sculptures were just freshly unfound, say like dug up from Pompeii and places like that, fragments of the history from the Parthenon and things like that. So it combines all these things, and it's very, very beautiful to come to and see if you wish to see it.
They've done a lot to Kenilworth Castle, including recreating the Elizabethan garden. Right now I'm speaking to the garden guide, Chris. Can you describe how the Queen's favourite, Robert Dudley, came to create the garden, please, and the reason?
The reason, because Robert Dudley wanted to impress the Queen, so he was putting all his influence and money into buying plants and exotic plants, exotic birds, an Italianate fountain. All of this stuff will be very expensive and shows his influence, and just to try to win her hand in marriage.
Great. And it's a kind of geometric garden. Was that the type in Elizabethan times?
Yeah, that would have been a Tudor knot garden style, yeah.
Yeah. And it was the first of its type in England, the garden, was
the Italianate garden was, yes.
Yeah. And then you've got a statue of Atlas. Holding up the wall,
yes.
Presumably it's Atlas.
Well, we don't really know whether it was actually Atlas. The man, Robert Langham, who described the fountain for us, just said it was two athlants holding a bowl. So it could have been a bowl or a ball.
Yeah.
So they decided to recreate it as, Atlas-type figures holding a ball, which could be the world. We're just interpreting that.
And the big fountain's got a joke feature as well.
Yes, that's got a big joke feature, because when Elizabeth brought her noble friends round and they got a bit hot under the collar with all the different scents and sights that they see,
the naked statue,
yeah. Well, it's not quite naked. Some
no.
of them are a little bit, yeah. Well, for Elizabethan times they're a little bit risque, but she could have someone make a little water shoot come out and wet their toes or their trousers and call their ardour, as it was put.
And that's around the base of the fountain. It squirts.
A little bit of water, yes. And apparently that was an original joke from the time of Elizabeth.
Right, so what do you think of Kenilworth Castle, Graham?
Good improvements to make it more accessible, yeah.
Yeah, you were able to walk up the staircases and see where Queen Elizabeth stayed. Well, very nice, and the beautiful gardens, the Elizabethan gardens, absolutely beautiful. Okay, so it's all from me and Graham from Kenilworth Castle. Bye!
Yeah, bye!
And with that story of Robert Dudley's wooing of Elizabeth, we come to the end of another Outlook. So from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the team here, it's goodbye for another week.